We may now turn for a little to the book of Psalms, and we come to the Psalm 14, which according to the title is another one of the Psalms of David. Like so many other of the Psalms, there is no indication as to when he actually wrote it or the circumstances under which he wrote it. But in this Psalm, we see that which is grieving to the psalmist, and he refers to it as a child of God, a child of grace, and we learn, I trust, from what he writes, what the attitude of a godly man or a godly woman ought to be in a godless and God-denying society. The psalmist here is looking around him at the society in which he lives. He's very conscious of the thinking of his fellows, and yet he sees in the midst of all the ungodliness evidence of the grace of God. And in the fourth verse of this psalm, we read these words, verse 4, "Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord?" And notice those words here in the midst of the psalm, "my people." Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord? And so, as you would expect, when we come across such an expression, it automatically has to be of interest to us. What is God saying about his people? Why is our attention drawn to God's people, the people that he says belong to him, my people? We have, of course, many references in the scriptures to this same claim, the Lord speaking of his people and of the great interest they are to him. If we go back to the book of Exodus, Moses is sent by God into Egypt to confront Pharaoh and to direct Pharaoh to release the Hebrew captives in Egypt. And God, in verse 7 of Exodus 3, we read, "The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people." You see, God's eye is always on his people, wherever they are, whatever their circumstances. They are a special interest. They are his people whom he has chosen, whom he has redeemed, whom he loves. They are the very apple of his eye. And so wherever they are, whatever their circumstances, he is interested in them because they're his possession. And here he tells Moses, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people." Now, we might well think, well, should the people of God be afflicted? We know, of course, that the people referred to here are the children of Jacob, the descendants of Jacob, chosen by God as his covenant people. But they are his people, and they are afflicted, "my people which are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows." What an amazing thing. God knows their sorrows. He knows their afflictions. He is interested in them. He understands perfectly their circumstances because of this very fact, they are his people. In verse 8 of this same chapter, he says, "I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians," and so on. And then in verse 9, now therefore behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me. I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. God is speaking about what he has heard, what he has seen, what he has observed, and it is all in connection with his people. He has been observing the treatment of his people. He's been observing the affliction of his people. He's been aware of the sorrow of his people. And in verse 10 then he says, come now therefore, I will send thee unto Pharaoh that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So here we have evidence sufficient to convince us that the Lord does have a special interest in his people, because he has, does not prevent them from affliction or from sorrow or from grief. They experience that, but he still knows all about it, and in his own time he will deal with it. And when we come to Psalm 14, here we have God mentioning in this psalm, my people. And he speaks of how they're being treated. He is aware of how they're being treated. And he is here going to deal with those who ill-treat them and those who, as it is said here, eat them as bread. They devour them. They eat up the people of God. Now, the first thing we want to note in this psalm about these people, the Lord's people, is their surroundings and their environment. They are not in heaven. They are not glorified. They are in this world, a fallen world. They are living in a real world, in a real society. There is no escaping from this. And those who they are living with don't have any appreciation for them. They don't have any love for them. And nevertheless, that's where the Lord has them. In his divine providence, that's where they are. The Lord could put them in very different circumstances, in a very different environment, but this is where they are. This is where he wants them to be, and this is where he keeps them at this particular time. So let's look at the society that the Lord's people are found in. Going back to the beginning of the psalm, in verse 2 we read, the Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men, the whole of human society. Now let me ask you something. Do you imagine God has stopped looking down? He doesn't look anymore. God doesn't have to look because he already knows. He knows everything because he's omniscient. Nevertheless, he looks down, and the idea here is that God is looking with a scrutinizing look to see if society really is bad and wicked. And yet, the God who's looking down, the God who is real, the God who has taken an interest in human society is not believed in. Verse 1, we read, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fool has said in his heart, doesn't necessarily require him to say it with his lips. He says it secretly. He says it in his heart. Now, in the Hebrew mind, of course, what is meant is the mind itself. In his mind, this is what he's thinking. He doesn't necessarily express it and say, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, I don't believe God exists. But what is secret in his heart comes out in his actions, in his lifestyle. And Solomon said, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And here we're told, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now you think to yourself, perhaps, well, in the past, men believed in God or gods, and they feared gods. Who could possibly deny the existence of God? Yet we go away back here into the days of David. And he was aware in the society in which he lived, there were those even then who foolishly denied God. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean they actually denied the existence of God, but they denied God. They kept him out of everything. They didn't want him involved in anything, and they didn't want to be personally involved with God. They wanted God out of the way. And this is the society in which God's people are. To them, God is central. To them, God is everything. And yet they're surrounded by those who think opposite to what they do, who think entirely differently. And you can see how society has become depraved when we read the words, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. When you go over to Romans chapter 1, we are there told of those who deny the evidence of the existence of God, the power of God, all the witnesses, all the evidence of the reality of God. They deny it. We're told in verse 18 of Romans 1, the wrath of God. Sometimes when we read certain portions of God's word, we wonder, does the church even believe the Bible? And we wonder sometimes, do Christians actually face up to reality? Do their expectations, do they agree with what God's word says? The wrath of God is revealed from heaven. God looks down in the psalm from heaven. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. All ungodliness, not just certain forms of ungodliness, not just extreme ungodliness, but all ungodliness. Now you and I take a look around in our society. Do we see evidence of ungodliness? Do we believe our society manifests ungodliness? And do we perhaps think, well, it's sad that our society is so corrupted? Or do we fear that the wrath of God that can be revealed at any moment from heaven, that wrath against all ungodliness could break upon us at any moment? This is what Paul writes. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. When men are ungodly and they behave ungodly, they are provoking heaven, and God's people sometimes have a tendency to ignore that. Well, that's not the day we're living in. That doesn't happen. God is so gracious. God is so patient. God is so loving. That's all we hear about today. God is a God of love, and he truly is. But God is a God of divine justice. And here we have this warning and why it is. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Because why does God manifest his wrath? Why is it revealed from heaven? Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. God has actually revealed himself, but still he's denied. God has actually given the evidence of his very own existence, and he reveals his wrath because men are denying him and sinning against him, denying the evidence that he actually exists. And here we read, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. It's not as if they're searching for evidence and are struggling to try and find sufficient. The apostle writes, the evidence is clear. It's seen. You would have to be blind not to see it. That's what Paul's really saying. You would have to be totally blind, intellectually as well as physically, not to see the evidence. The evidence is so clear. And therefore there is no excuse when men deny it. The invisible things are seen so that at the end of verse 20, they are without excuse. That's why the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. Because there's no excuse for what they're doing or how they're behaving, why they are so recklessly sinful. And then in verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Why is he a fool? Because, as we're told, they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. This is a judgment in itself. It's a judgment from God when he leaves men incapable of actually being able to receive the evidence. It's a judgment from God when the evidence is clear. And as I said, you would have to be entirely blind not to see it. And yet their foolish hearts are darkened. And they're left to themselves. Now when we go back to Psalm 14, what do we read? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The kind of society that is described in Romans 1, a God-provoking society, and the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against it. And in the midst of all this wickedness and all this abominable, disagreeable conduct and behavior against the evidence, God has his people. They're living in the midst of all this. Now, we are told they're saying there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. Now, when we read this Psalm 14, if you go to Psalm 53, it's almost exactly the same Psalm. Psalm 53 and Psalm 14, except for just a few words, are actually the same Psalms. You go to Psalm 53, verse 1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, and so on. So we might wonder, well, is there any necessity to have two Psalms that are basically the same? Well, God has a good reason for everything. And in the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word is to be established. And these two Psalms, being so similar, are indeed a witness to the reality that men, because of the depravity of their natures, are so defiant of God, they so want God excluded from their very thinking and their society, that they are prepared to go against God and provoke the very wrath of God against themselves. Again, you have in the epistle that Paul writes to the Romans in the third chapter, it is from these two Psalms that he actually quotes. As we're all familiar, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. There's none righteous, no, not one, for all have sinned, and so on. Now, the psalmist here speaks of the society, the environment in which God has his people. My people are in the midst of all this. But the Lord looks down. And he looked down just as he did in Egypt. He looked down from heaven upon the children of men. And this is what he's looking for. To see if there were any that did understand and seek God. God is not looking here for the mighty or the rich or the powerful or the influential. He's looking to see among the sons of men, are there any who are seeking God? They're seeking everything but God. They're seeking material gain. God is looking down. He sees what they're pursuing. He sees you and I day by day. How forgetful we can be of that fact. God is looking down in the very spot where you and I are working. He's looking down upon us when we're speaking, when we're acting, when we're sleeping, when we're resting, whatever we're doing. God is looking down. And what is his verdict when he sees us? Does he see us seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness? Does he see that? Does he see us seeking the one thing needful? Does he see us seeking to please him in everything? Does he see us concerned for his glory, or does he see us in pursuit of what the ungodly are seeking? God looks down on this generation, a pleasure-crazy generation seeking the pleasures of sin that are but for a season. That's what God's seeing. He's seeing the church that professes his name and the people who profess his name, and they're no different from the unconverted and the ungodly. They all seem to be pursuing the same things. Doesn't seem to be any difference. And here you see is the situation when God looks down, he's concerned as, are there any who are seeking me at all? Are there any who are thinking differently? The fool is saying in his heart, there isn't any God. in spite of all the evidence, but God's looking, are there any among all this wicked society who are actually seeking God? And then in verse 3, the psalmist says, they're all gone aside, they're all together become filthy. That word filthy in the original has the idea of that which is like a carcass. It can actually, some translate it, stink. It is speaking of death and decay and rottenness, a society that is morally decayed. And this is where God's people are. Now you remember what Jesus said concerning even his elect, that things could get to such a low state that even the elect could be deceived. And he said, because iniquity abounds, the love of many waxes cold. And that's what God's people have to be ever looking out for. You remember what Jesus, the head of the church, said to the church when the seven churches in Asia are addressed? Church in Ephesus, thou hast left thy first love. Now, when those words are read out in the church in Ephesus, how would you expect those who heard them to be reacting? What would they be doing if they were sincere? They'd be looking back. Christ is saying, we've left our first love, which indicates clearly there was a time when our hearts were warmer. It was a time in the past we were more zealous. We were more willing to follow Christ and bear his cross. We're not as where we used to be. We've left something behind. And here you see is the danger when society becomes corrupt like this. God's people can become desensitized. You think of it, I can remember when I was younger working on the farm. Anyone who's ever been about a farm will know there are peculiar smells with animals and with manure, farm smells. Now, if you got someone from the city appearing in the scene, you will find they're walking around holding their nose and they're disgusted and they think this is shocking. And yet those who live there think absolutely nothing of it. They're not even aware of anything peculiar. And that's, you see, what happens in the kind of society that here the psalmist is writing about. It is a dangerous society when things become as they are described here. The people of God have got to be watchful. They've got to know where they are. They've got to understand the dangers. And they've got to be aware that they can become so familiar day after day. Things are just the same and getting worse. And they can come to the conclusion, well, we just have to live with it. We can't change it. We can't do anything about it. Or we just live with it. And they accept it as normal. It's just the way it is. But you see, the psalmist is speaking of what is happening as being abominable works, provoking God, and the people of God are in the midst of it. You remember what Peter says of Lot. Lot, who dwelt in the wicked cities that were doomed to destruction, he vexed his righteous soul with a filthy conversation of the cities. He was vexing his soul And yet he didn't do anything about it. He didn't try to get his family out of the cities. He didn't remove himself from it. He was content to stay there until the angels had to come and drag them out. And yet there he was, vexing his righteous soul with a filthy conversation. He knew it is abominable to God. And he never seemed to come to realize, I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be among this. For my family's sake, I should get them out. And you know what happened, of course, when the angels came and told Lot to get out and get his family out. When he spoke to his sons-in-law, he seemed like one that was, they just mocked him. They just treated him as a joke. Why was that? Because of his inconsistency. Why do men and women treat the church and many who profess the name of Christ hardly better than a joke? It's because they are witnesses to inconsistency. The church is supposed to hate sin. The people of God are supposed to keep from sin, avoid sin, sinful conduct, sinful behavior, sinful contacts, and yet they see, well, whatever we do, they do, and they don't see any difference. They don't see any separation from the world, any separation from ungodliness. They don't see it. Now here, the description that we have here is a description of those who are just like in Romans 1, provoking heaven, provoking the wrath of God. They are all gone aside. What did Paul tell us in Romans? When they knew God, they denied him. Here we read, they are all gone aside. They have digressed, they have forsaken the truth, they've abandoned the evidence, they don't want to hear it, they don't want to see it. It's just like you imagine a man and he's got cancer and it's going to kill him, and the surgeon wants to show him the evidence. He says, no, I don't believe I've got cancer. The surgeon says, you certainly have, sir. Here's the evidence. Look at these pictures from your scan. Look at them. I don't want to see them. I'm not interested in the evidence. I don't have cancer. Wouldn't you be thinking, well, what a fool you are? And that's the kind of fools that the Lord has his people living among. They are all gonna say, they are become filthy. There was a time they were different, but society is on the slide downward and downward and downward. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. What is society? We might think our day is bad, but here we find that when we go back centuries, the Church of Christ, the body of God's people, have existed in the midst of a society that is ever corrupt, because when man denies God, when he puts God out, then there are no more restraints upon him. He is entirely without any sense of accountability to God. He's accountable to no one but himself in the end. And yet, here's what God, through the psalmist, says in verse 4. And this is what I want us to note regarding the people of God, not only their surroundings, but their treatment at the hands of the ungodly. You would think if people believe there's no God I don't have to be accountable to any God or any authority, any supreme being. Just look after myself. And they're so clever and they're so enlightened that they think this way. Well, then they will just ignore those poor, pathetic souls who happen to claim to believe in God. But that is something they can't do. That is a grief to them, that these who are the people of God are such an irritant to them. Look at what we read. These workers of iniquity, have they no knowledge? Do they not understand what they're doing? They eat my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord. They want to destroy God's people because the people of God in their midst are an irritant. And they're there by God's purpose for a reason, as you'll see in a moment. But you see, those who deny the existence of God, they naturally are opposed to those who believe in God. Since they don't want any mention of God, they don't want anything to do with God, they want every reference of God to be removed out of their thinking, out of society. They want it eradicated. And yet here are these people, and they believe in God. And here are these people, and the psalmist tells us, verse 6, ye have shamed the counsel of the poor because the Lord is his refuge. They not only believe in God, but they believe that God is their refuge, that in the midst of all the ungodliness, God is still taking care of them and is still protecting them and is still preserving them. But you will see why they do object so much to my people. Because we're told in verse 5, there were they in great fear, or they feared fear. They feared fear. It was an unusual fear. It was a unique fear. And what's the cause of it? What is causing them? If there's no God, why would they fear? If they've eradicated God out of their society, what have they to be afraid of? It's the people of God, my people, who cause this. Because we're told, there were they in great fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. Something is staring them right in the face. They're saying there's no God. And here are these people, and they're the people of God. And they're causing anxiety, and they're causing fear. Why? Because God, whom they're denying, God, whom they're wanting to annihilate out of society, God is in the generation of the righteous. Who are this? Who is this generation of the righteous? God is righteous. So these who are righteous, what's special about them? They are bearing the image of God. And these people say there is no God. And the one thing then that really troubles them is beholding those who are bearing the very image of God. And so they can't eradicate out of their minds, no matter how hard they try. Here are these people, and their very lives, their very testimony, their very lifestyle is saying, there is a God. We are the people of God. We are the people who know God. We are the people who bear the image of God, who have been redeemed and who've been restored into fellowship and communion with Him. Ye have shamed the counsel of the poor. What kind of counsel? The very lives of these who are the people of God are saying, God is. You look at the evidence down through history of the godly men and godly women, how they lived, and those who are saying there's no God, they cannot possibly deny the fact there are people and they believe God is their refuge. And when they have troubles, they go to God with them. And when they have problems, they call on God, they pray to God, they believe God, they trust God, they rest upon God by faith. And we're saying there is no God, and yet this people seem to have a relationship with God that's real. And God is a relationship with them that's real. They pray and He answers. They call upon Him and He responds. And you see, this is one of the things that those who strut around supposedly being very clever, saying, well, we don't believe in God. It's an old antiquated myth that there's a supreme being, that there's a God who interferes in human life and in human behavior and whatever else. And then you say, well, here's a humble man, woman, never was at Oxford, never was at Cambridge. But you know something? That man believes in God. And he prays to God. You don't believe that God exists, but He does. What happens then? Who is answering him? Who is responding? You don't believe God exists, so who's answering the prayers for this simple man or this simple woman? Who's responding when they go as a to God as a refuge? And you see, this is what the psalmist says causes the fear. The fool says there's no God, but he's very uncertain. He puts on the great show as though he's full of confidence, but there's one thing that shakes his confidence, and it's the godliness of the people of God. My people, I have put them there to be a real witness. I have put them there where they trust me. I have put them there to convict these who are so confident in their own ignorance. And then you see, as the psalm concludes, that in the midst of all this darkness and ungodliness, my people have a glorious hope. They're not in despair. They're not going to compromise. They're not going to sell out, as it were, to all this God-provoking behavior and conduct. But in verse 7, we read there, oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion. When the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. The psalmist in Psalm 119 speaks of how the tears ran down his cheeks when he saw how the ungodly lived. It was a grief to him. And it is a grief to the people of God. The true people of God are really grieved. They cannot find it in themselves to be submissive to the godlessness, to be any part of it, to be involved with it. But God has his people there that out of that the salvation of Israel may come out of Zion. When the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. What are they hopeful of? Well, God is our refuge. God is his refuge. And in Psalm 46, we read there, God is our refuge, our present help in every time of trouble. And however dark the day is, we have the confidence that the knowledge of the Lord shall cover the earth. Even though they are saying presently, there is no God. Yet, the promise of God remains. The day will come when they will have to acknowledge there is a God. And if it doesn't happen in time, it will happen in eternity. When men are faced with the great white throne and the judgment day, and they begin to call upon the rocks and the mountains to fall upon them and hide them from the face of him who sits upon the throne, they will then know there is a God. There is a God. We denied him, but now we face him. But this psalm reminds us of where God has his people. However low things are, God is his people as the salt in the earth, the light in the world. You remember how Abraham was there, Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed, but there is the friend of God interceding, pleading. There are 10 righteous men saved the place. And you see, no matter how godless a society is, God has a people and he claims them in the midst of it all. They're my people. And they're there for a reason. They're there for a purpose. And that's the reality that you and I should acknowledge ourselves. Our day is a godless day. But we are the people of God by grace. And we're in the midst of it all. Not to compromise with it, but to bear witness by our personal godliness. A man should be able to say, well, there's something peculiar about that man. There's something unusual about that woman. They claim to believe in God, and God is real to them. Do they believe that? Do the ungodly believe that God is real to you and me? He's real. It's not just a theory or something we talk about, but he's real. And they can't deny that. That's what this psalmist draws our attention to. But we shall leave it there. May God bless his word.